south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander...
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, back in the saddle again. You know, I get lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of emails and questions about things. Why not? I'm supposed to be the answer guy, right, when it comes to Latin America anyway. And, as you well know, I give lots and lots of things away for free. I don't really sell anything at all. I don't make anything off of clicks. I'm not invested in any products that are for sale. The only thing I really charge for is my seminars and my Latin American healthcare report, which is, I think, $20. Of course, you longtime listeners know I do phone consults with people, too. They aren't free, but they're specifically tailored to people who have lots and lots of questions that I can't answer on the air. Mostly personal questions, tailored to their specifics. People are always trying to get the hell out of Dodge, and they've got specific needs and wants. And this show, The Expat Files Living in Latin America, is more about generalities, with the occasional specific case or boots-on-the-ground story thrown in for shock value or because it's in the news or just shits and grins. So, by all means, keep those cards, letters, and emails coming. Because you do have good questions most of the time. But please, just one or two questions per email. Please don't give me an index file full of all your wants and needs. Don't give me your laundry list. For that, you'll have to do a half an hour or hour consult call with me. For example, I got this email the other day, and here's what he's asking. He says, Johnny, please talk about your border experiences by bus. Maybe you can talk about your border crossing experiences by foot as well. Oh, and crypto. Keep talking about crypto. And tell us your opinion on staking in crypto. Then he says, I'm going to Lake Atitlan in Guatemala soon. What are your favorite places of cultural or other interests that are must-sees? And can you please speak about banking too? And can you please speak about traveling and phone communications in general when using a U.S. phone or internet provider? But that's not all. There's more. He says, can you talk about your go-to for inexpensive air flights? You know what? All very good questions, right? But sometimes I just get the feeling that people who fire off a lot of questions like that in an email, they're tacaños, cheapskates. They want a lot of answers, but they don't want to do a phone consult because then it's not free. Hey, don't get me wrong. I like free stuff too, but I try to give as much as I get. I give away lots of free stuff. Now, as far as the emails and email questions I read on the air, you better believe I get a shit ton of them with a list of questions as long as my arm. Like the guy I just referred to. And guess what happens to those? I write back saying, you need a phone consult, bub. And guess what? Probably only 10% of those sign up for a consult. And that, of course, means the other 90% were just trying to get free advice. They didn't want to pay for a consult, which is totally okay with me. Hey, there's a whole gigantic subculture of tacaños, you know, cheapskates, roaming the cities, the boonies, and the jungles of Latin America. They're known as backpackers. Anyway, I'm not passing judgment here. In fact, I have a childhood buddy who's an expert cheapskate. Man, he could write a book on the subject. 10 books on the subject, but he doesn't have a computer. He's too cheap. Oh, and the fact that I've got teachers in the family. My mom's a professor, you know. She's tight, but not a cheapskate. She still tips 10%, calculated down to the 10th decimal point. That means I've been surrounded by a class of cheapskates all my life. I'll tell you, it's murder going out to dinner with a bunch of teachers. They spend more time sussing out the bill and calculating the tip down to 10 decimal points than they do eating. Then there's always that guy or gal who slips off to the bathroom just as they're chipping in for the tip. Oh, and a bit of full disclosure here. I've had a couple of girlfriends call me a cheapskate. And then the moment it hurts, you feel a little self-conscious about that. You're wondering, am I really a tightwad? Does it show? Well, my guilt about that lasted only a couple of weeks when I got together with some of my buddies. I mentioned it. And guess what? Every last one of them had the same story. They had at least one or two girlfriends in their lives that called them cheapskates. I guess in relationships that are failing, it seems to be an insult of last resort. Like expat Eddie says, and he ought to know, he owned lots of restaurants. He says, isn't it funny how every guy's been called a cheapskate by his girlfriend or wife when he's perceived as an under-tipper? Meanwhile, on a date, it's always the guy doing the tipping. Funny, she insults him, yet she's got no skin in the game. Cheapskate or not, it's usually the guy who always ends up paying the tip. But I digress as usual. Man, did I digress. All right, at the risk of actually sticking with the topic matter, here is a really interesting email. This one comes from Burke, B-U-R-K-E. Don't know if it's a guy or a gal, or somewhere in between. Burke says, Johnny, how many expats who come down to live permanently are divorced? How many are single and how many are married couples or just couples? What's the mix? Good question, Burke. Well, I could tell you about my seminars. I've done 19 of them so far. I can tell you the breakdown there, and it's probably pretty close to the average gringo expat population. I'd say about 80 to 90% of the people who come down alone, people who are single, they've been previously divorced. And I'd say about 40% of the people who come down to my seminars are married couples. Or maybe they're not married, but living together, you know, couples anyway. And I say about half of those couples are on their second or third marriages. So 50% of the couples who come down, it's their second or third marriage. So that's pretty much always the breakdown of my seminar attendees. About 40% couples, 60% singles, with 80 to 90% of the singles having been previously divorced. Oh, and about divorces, here's a crazy statistic I ran across not so long ago. Did you know that up in the States anyway, in Canada and the first world, when it comes to divorce, overwhelmingly, women are the ones who do the filing. Turns out 80% of the divorces filed in the States and Canada are initiated by the women. And that number jumps to 90% if the woman's university educated. Now, if you're wondering why that is, well, according to experts, that would be divorce lawyers and couples counselors. They say it's because women, before any divorce happens, get together and talk about it with each other. And guys don't. When a marriage is rocky, the guys keep it to themselves. They don't like to share those things with their buddies. Meanwhile, the ladies get together, they talk about what could happen during and after a divorce, and they know that whoever files first gets better terms, like keeping the kids, getting the house, the car, etc. Besides that, according to experts, the person who files first usually catches the other person off guard. Then they're in a panic or a scramble to get things together. You know, bank statements, assets, income tax records. Turns out, oftentimes, when someone serves another for divorce, it's a surprise even if they've been talking about divorce for a while, since this subject does come up when couples are squabbling, and they generally don't follow through right away. It could take months. Oh, and by the way, when you hear wokesters talk so militantly about gender equity, well, I guess that doesn't apply to divorces, because statistically, and you can look this up, 97% of all the alimony paid in the United States goes to women. Now, speaking of divorce, I was checking out the top 10 reasons Americans, that is divorced couples, have given for the cause of their divorce. I also checked out a Latin American counseling site and checked out their top 10 reasons for getting divorced down here in Latin America. Guess what? There's quite a difference. Let's talk about Americans getting divorced first. According to the Austin Institute for the Study of Family and Culture, using data from 4,000 divorced adults, turns out the top reason for Americans is infidelity or extramarital affair. Number two, severe money or problems with finances. Number three, lack of communication. Number four, constant disagreements and arguments. Number five, weight gain. Think about that for a second. I mean, we all have our standards, right? What's your spousal or better half limit for excessive weight gain? 30, 50, 100, 200 pounds overweight? I know, it's for better or for worse, but come on. But where were we? Oh yeah, top 10 reasons for divorce, according to U.S. statistics. Number six, unrealistic expectations. Number seven, lack of intimacy. Number eight, lack of equality. In other words, one person in the relationship is doing all the heavy lifting and the other, well, is a slug. Number nine, the decision to marry too quickly, poor preparation for marriage. Number 10, physical or mental abuse. Okay. So those are the top 10 reasons for American divorces. Now, how about Latin American divorces? Number one, inequality. In other words, one person is doing all the heavy lifting and the other is just a slug. And or he has abandoned his responsibilities to the family completely. Notice I said he because 99% of the time, you see it's the Latina wife doing all the heavy lifting and it's the guy who's the no-account slug. Number two, physical abuse. Lots and lots of drunk-ass wife beaters in Latin America. Notice that showed up as number 10 on the American list and number 2 on the Latin American divorce list. That just goes to show you the power of macho here in Latin America. Number 3, trouble with money or finances. Number 4, lack of intimacy. Number 5, marital affairs and infidelity. Remember, that was reason number 1 on the divorce list for American couples. It kind of, once again, supports the fact that Latin American women are used to their men cheating on them, and therefore don't put it high on the list for their reasons for divorce. It shows Latinas are more lenient about it. They're more willing to let it slide. After all, their dads cheated on their moms, but they're still married, and their brothers cheated on their wives, and they're still married. Well, unfortunately, on this list of reasons for Latin American divorces, this particular poll only lists the top 5. But you get the idea, it's much different than the reasons Americans have. For one thing, you probably noticed, excessive weight gain did not show up as a reason for a divorce on the Latin American side of the list. I don't really think you could get away with saying that as a reason for a divorce down here. Hey, not that millions of Latinos and Latinas don't tip the scales. They do. It just doesn't seem much of a concern down here. By the way, on a slightly related topic, have you seen the news lately? The headline being oral sex causes oral cancer? Or at least, according to stats, increases your risk of oral cancer by 400%. And deeper into the article, it said that California is a hotbed for that kind of cancer. Then I remember Hollywood guy Val Kilmer. And Michael Douglas and Stanley Tucci were afflicted with it too. So what do you think? A little after Oscar party threesome? Maybe not, but just wondering. You know what else I was wondering? Where's California going to put the warning sticker? Or do you think maybe it'll be a mandatory delivery room tattoo? Just wondering. By the way, the other day I was talking to one of my really nerdy engineering buddies about that oral cancer thing. He said, "Johnny, I'm not worried. Zero risk for me. Last time I was inside a woman was my high school field trip to the Statue of Liberty." Supposed to be a drum roll and a cymbal crash there, right? Anyway, here's a little comment I have about gringos and expats moving down here for their plan B. Specifically, a comment about older couples coming down. It seems the greatest group of older married couples that moved down are people that get their information from rags like International Living and AARP. They mostly end up in very gringoized places like Costa Rica or Medellin or Ecuador because they've been advertised over and over again as gringo hotspots that are safe. Whereas I seem to see a lot more single gringos and expats moving out in the boonies, especially younger single gringos and expats in the 35 to 50 range. I spend most of my time off the gringo tourist trail, and I can verify that fact. It seems like the older you are when you decide to move down and get that plan B going, the more you're likely to settle into a gringoized place because, obviously, you want to hang with gringos because your Spanish sucks. But more importantly, as you get older, you have medical issues, and it seems the closer you are to the gringo tourist trail, the more convenient availability of doctors, clinics, and hospitals. At least that's the line I've been hearing lately from older gringos and expats, but it's not necessarily true. The fact is now, in pretty much everywhere in Latin America, off and on the gringo tourist trail, there are plenty of first world style hospitals, doctors, and clinics. The thing is, though, the farther you're off the gringo tourist trail, the less likely they are to speak English, which can and will be a problem if you have some kind of medical issue and your Spanish really sucks. So suppose you have a medical issue, you have to call an ambulance. The ambulance comes. They don't speak English. But they do their job, they see you've got private insurance, so they take you to the nearest emergency room in a first-world-style private hospital. So far, so good. Well, once you're in the emergency room reception area, chances are the nurses, the receptionists, the grunt workers will not speak English. So again, if your Spanish sucks, it's going to be a problem. However, the personnel in the hospital, immediately knowing there is a language barrier, they'll summon one of the docs or interns who always speaks some English. At that point, you'll be in good hands. But again, once you're admitted and you go in for lab tests or you end up even staying overnight, whatever, when you're off the gringo tourist trail, you can only pretty much count on speaking English to the docs. There's likely to be a communication breakdown between you and the nurses. However, if you happen to be living on the gringo tourist trail, let's say Costa Rica, Panama, if you end up in a doctor's office or a hospital or a clinic, there'll always be nurses there that'll speak English, receptionists and lab workers too. So that's sort of the state of things and why so many older couples end up on the gringo tourist trail. By older couples, I mean over 55 or 60. I mean, really, how many people do you know over 55 or 60 years old who aren't constantly going to a doctor's office for something or other? The fact is, and it's natural, that older couples are a lot less adventurous than younger couples. That's another thing that keeps them on the gringo tourist trail. The fact is, I run into lots of 35 or 40-year-old younger couples doing just fine and living the best kind of expat life well off the gringo tourist trail, and they love it there. Which, by the way, is one of the quickest and easiest ways to really learn your Spanish, too. When you dive into the deep end and your Spanish really sucks and all you got around you are Spanish speakers, no denying, communication will be tough for the first couple of months, but your Spanish will kick in and you'll be really glad you toughed it out. And even if your Spanish really sucks, I recommend you start out off the gringo tourist trail, because with all those translation apps, they're everywhere. And so convenient, too, that they can even become a crutch. Don't let that happen. But anyway, if you use one, and newbies use them all the time, it might take an extra minute or two to get your point across in a grocery store, bank, or gas station. But as long as you've got your cell phone with you with decent internet service, you can do the back and forth on your screen and get your point across with no problem at all. Then, soon enough, usually takes a couple of months. That is, unless you're Oscar Mayer or Captain Mango, you won't need your phone as a translation crutch anymore. Now, I'm not specifically picking on Captain Mango or Oscar Mayer. Well, maybe I am. But these are two very smart guys who've been down here for years now, off the gringo tourist trail completely. Yet they just don't want to go all in on learning Spanish. Now, of course, that happens all the time if you're on the gringo tourist trail. Sometimes you never can learn your Spanish, because all the locals are trying to speak English to you so they could get a job in tourism and get paid in U.S. dollar tips. I just don't get it. I know so many gringos and expats who've been living off the gringo tourist trail for some years, who've been down here a while, and they don't speak Spanish. Well, kitchen Spanish, which is enough to talk to your cleaning lady and gardener and do your shopping and banking. But, you know, with kitchen Spanish, you can't really have a complete conversation with anyone. You can give orders, tell people what to do, but you're not going to be able to just plain converse. But it seems lots and lots of gringos and expats, even off the gringo tourist trail, they reach a kind of a plateau. Once they can get just enough Spanish across to deal with daily chores and such, that's where their Spanish learning curve ends. By the way, that's exactly what happened to me when I first landed in Costa Rica. I was there 2.5 years, and my Spanish was just about that of a 5-year-old. After that, when I left Costa Rica to go completely off the gringo tourist trail, I think what saved me from being a Spanish language cripple was that there were no smartphones. There were cell phones, but not smartphones. Therefore, no translation apps. And man, I used to marvel at gringos and expats who could speak Spanish. Sometimes I was just plain jealous. I thought, maybe I'll get there someday, but how? In fact, many times I thought I must be missing a certain piece of gray matter in my brain, the part that all these gringo expats who speak Spanish seem to have. Of course, later I did find out that most of them took Spanish back in the States when they were in high school, or even majored in it in college, which made me feel even more inadequate, because in high school I took French. Duh, what did I know? But again, I digress. Where were we? Oh yeah, reading another email. Coming from longtime listener Rod, he says, "Hi, Johnny. I'm addicted to your show. What a great podcast." You know, I could have skipped that part, right? But sometimes you let your ego get the best of you. He says, "Johnny, you mentioned in a previous show there'll be some amazing upcoming buying opportunities in Caracas, Venezuela, real estate. All coming up in the future, though." He says, "My mother actually lives there, Caracas, Venezuela, so I get reports from the place on a regular basis." He says, "You mentioned deals in Caracas will be forthcoming in the future, but actually, the deals can be had currently as well." He says, "Apartments in great neighborhoods in Caracas, areas without slums attached, you can get for about $300 a square meter. A square meter has around 10 square feet, so that's about $30 a square foot." All right, let me stop for a second and suss those numbers out for you. He's talking about $30 a square foot. To reference that number back to something everyone can understand, I just looked it up, and the average cost to buy or build an apartment or house in the United States is $125 to $150 a square foot. So what Rod's telling us here is that at $30 a square foot, you can buy apartments and I guess houses too, right? For 1/5 the cost of an equivalent house or apartment in the U.S. But, he says, and we kind of knew this already, you have to be there to get those kind of deals. You have to hang out there, ask around, make sure everyone knows you're not in a hurry to buy, ask about apartments and houses that have been empty for a while, etc. There's a reason for that, too. He says there are tons of real estate listings available, but they're not listed online. In other words, he says owners are happy to sell, happy to offload, but they're just not interested enough to put their listing online. All right, me Johnny here. Brad, why do you think that is? Why do you think people want to sell, but they don't put it online? It's because they think maybe there aren't any buyers out there, people don't have cash? Is it just maybe that the market is really soft, really weak, and properties aren't turning over, so they don't bother to put it online? It would be interesting to find out. What do you think? Anyway, Rod gives us a list here of things to look into when trying to find those deals in Caracas, Venezuela. He says, a few tips here. Number one, check out the pagos de condominio, which translates to condominium payments or condo fees. He says, lots of times the owners of these condos have stopped paying condo fees for years, which are U.S. dollar denominated. If you buy the property, you'll be on the hook for that. Number two, he says, look out for tenants. If the apartment is rented out, just don't buy it. It's almost impossible to evict a tenant in Venezuela, which also means you should not buy with the intention of renting. He says you don't want to be a landlord in Venezuela. Then he says, look out for a thing called, quote, derecho de frente, which translates, by the way, to right in front. So what's that mean? Well, it's the Venezuelan designation for property taxes, which Rod says didn't used to be a big deal at all because it was denominated in bolivars. And we all know inflation killed the bolivar. But he says if this fee, the Venezuelan property tax, hasn't been paid in decades, it may have built up to a point that it might be an issue. Tip number four, he says, don't buy houses or properties unless you will have someone living there. If no one's going to be there permanently, buy a condo. He says, even in good neighborhoods, an empty house will be filled with squatters in no time and you can't evict them. Tip number five, he says, some of the old buildings from the 30s and 40s are really beautiful. They have marble entrances and mid-century architecture, but Caracas is in a seismic zone. He says there have been several big earthquakes, and only buildings designed after a certain point in history are earthquake-proof, have seismic reinforcement. He says, unfortunately, I don't know the exact year when seismic-resistant buildings started being constructed, but you can easily find out. Just ask a local architect. Though, note, Rod says that old colonial homes and structures never seem to get damaged during earthquakes. So if you're going to live in one of those, you'll be safe no matter the age of the property. Tip number six. Rod says in Caracas, Venezuela, there are lots of beautiful, luxurious apartment buildings, but lots of them look tacky to me anyway, he says. Sort of nouveau riche. They're well built, but they don't have any real class. Turns out, he says, the uneducated but rich Chavistas live there. Chavistas, by the way, are people who still follow the tenets of Hugo Chavez, which means generally they're the ones that benefited and made money off of socialism. Unlike the common people, they have the right political and family connections. Then Rod says, if you have a good eye for architecture and construction, you'll be able to tell the difference between the good, the bad, and the awesome buildings quickly. But one way, he says, to spot a really great building is to focus on the work of a German architect called Beckhoff. Full name, Federico Guillermo Beckhoff. Turns out he's a famous German architect who became Venezuelan and has even had expositions in the New York City Museum of Modern Art. His buildings are stunning and full of class. Then Rod says, anyway, Johnny, I hope this helps. Signed, Rod. Well, yeah, Rod, it sure does. Thanks for the tips. Though, I can tell you this, I've been to Caracas a few times, not lately, before COVID. And just like in the rest of Latin America, they love gringos and expats. That is, the common people, the working people on the street. But the government slugs, the government workers and the military, they've been bombarded with so much anti-gringo propaganda that once in a while, if you're spotted out as a gringo, in other words, if you're fair-haired, light-skinned, tall, you don't look like a Latino, you just might be stopped by the cops or a military and get a shakedown. In fact, I know a few gringos that happened to upon arrival at the Caracas airport. They got their luggage torn apart, got hassled for a while, lost an hour or two, and one of them told me he had some cash on him, something like 6,000 bucks. And he said while they were going through his stuff, he had a terrible feeling that if they found it, they'd have just kept it. Or they'd have put him in a back room, questioned him, and made him pay some kind of mordida, you know, a fine, a bribe. So, Rod, to me, although it looks like there are some fantastic deals to be had, I think a guy like me, a tall, fair-haired, light-skinned, blue-eyed gringo, would just get hassled every step of the way. After all, you got to hit a number of government offices to buy a piece of property. Or maybe not. What do you think? Last two times I was there, like I said, before COVID, I didn't get hassled, and I walked around quite a bit, and I went in some of the big shopping centers. It was nothing to buy, but still, it was worth a look. I didn't get hassled. Then, you know, I took the cable car up to the park. You know, that teleférico? By the way, being, you know, an engineer in a former life, I poked around a bit, and I noticed the construction plaque at the base of the cable spools, and I saw it was made in Switzerland. So naturally, I felt perfectly safe in that thing, as opposed to if it had said made in Colombia or Mexico. Does that make me classist or racist? I don't think so. How about a new word? Detailist. I prefer to engage with people, things, and machines that are all about the details. After all, I've seen how amusement park rides are constructed and maintained in places like Mexico. So anyway, I went up to the big park on the mountain in Caracas and took the teleférico, the cable car. Lots and lots of people there hanging out. And I didn't get hassled once, but I got a lot of strange looks because it seemed I was the only oddball gringo there. It kind of felt like people were staring at me. Not in a bad way, but you know what it's like when you walk into a room full of people you don't know and all eyes are on you? And you're thinking maybe your fly's down or you've got a piece of toilet paper stuck to your shoe or a loogie hanging from your nose. So anyway, Rod, you're absolutely correct about the fact that you should live there or hang around in Caracas for a while before you ever make a decision to buy anything. Still, it would be a huge advantage if you had some Venezuelan friends who live there that could help you out. The other thing, Rod, is the power outages. Funny thing, too, because Venezuela's got practically an unlimited supply of oil, yet they have regular power outages. Problem with that is, of course, if you live in a high-rise, high-rises have elevators, and when the power goes out, so do the elevators. Now, I understand all building codes throughout the world pretty much say this. If you've got more than four stories in your building, it's mandatory to have an elevator. And every elevator has to have its own backup generator just in case the power does go out. Sounds good, right? And that's the general practice, except remember that ubiquitous maintenance issue in Latin America? In many cases, the backup generator is sitting there ready to go, but there's no diesel or gas for it. Oops. And I know for a fact in some of the high-rise buildings, the ones in the crappier areas, the elevators haven't worked for years. I saw it for myself. I even took a few pictures. Of course, I'm talking about the living conditions for the sweaty masses. If you're living a little higher off the hog, I'm sure those problems don't exist. But having boots on the ground before you ever decide to buy is the only way to go.
South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.